Cool. Okay.
I had a very important meeting,
Oh, really?
management institute.
Cool. Okay. Thank you. thank you, Misha, and thank you, everybody, for inviting me. I'm going to talk about active behavior, active sensing, and how it affects neurodynamics. And as you all know, animals behave passively or actively in the environment. Sometimes it passively feels winds blowing by whiskers, or it sometimes actively whisk and touch an object to sense. And neurodynamics are different during active and passive behavior that has been explored. We would like to understand how using a modeling approach. So series of experiments from Carl Peterson's lab studied how whisking changes neurodynamics. And specifically, they looked at several conditions: free whisking condition, whisking in the air, active touch where a whisker touches a bar nearby, and a quiet awake condition where basically it's standing still. And they measure different neural signals, EEG, LFP, but also membrane potential and whisker position. And here I would like to explain two experimental observations. The first experimental observation is that whisking suppresses coherent neural fluctuations. So basically what they found is that when the animal is quiet, there is a coherent up and down of neural activity among a population of local neurons. And this coherent up and down is suppressed when animals perform whisking. And animal is awake, yeah. S1. Bar. Sorry?
Which layer?
Oh, this is, I think, layer 4. But the voltage sensitive dye from layer 2, 3 showed similar activity. So it's, and the EEG and LFP also showed this kind of activity. So it's not very specific to layer, I think. So what they found is that the slow fluctuations, 1 to 5 hertz, is big in the quiet condition, but when animals start whisking, this frequency is dropped. And also the correlation, when animal is quiet, there's a high correlation. High correlation is suppressed during whisking. And interestingly, during the touch condition, it's somewhere in between the quiet condition and the free whisking condition. So slow coherent fluctuation is suppressed during whisking. This is one experiment that I would like to explain.
Did the firing rate also change?
Firing rate, it's generally low firing rate, you know, in the barrel cortex. I don't know. I mean, this is...
not so much.
Not so much.
They actually say that the firing rate didn't change much.
Okay, so the second observation that I would like to explain is the sensory processing. And they found that whisking suppresses sensory response to passive whisker stimulation. What do I mean by passive whisker stimulation? They put the ion particle to a whisker and applied magnetic force to deflect the whisker. And they did it while animal is quiet or while animal is freely whisking. And they see this kind of change. Basically, during the quiet condition, animals respond to passive whisker diffraction with the more average spikes. But during the freely whisking condition, the response is suppressed. So the response to passive stimulation is suppressed. And interestingly, they also looked at active touch condition.
But you have this strong response. The error is when the stimulation is applied.
The blue one is when animal is quiet.
No, I understand. I'm looking at the red one. I see a very...
Later.
No, this vertical... This, what is this? This is not a response?
I think this is an artifact. Artifact. Artifact of magnetic pulse. And they also looked at active touch condition, animal voluntary touch an object, a bar. And there, they reliably saw depolarization of the membrane potential. So what is the difference between this passive stimulus and the active touch is also a question. There are some suggestions. And I would like to explain these two experiments. And just going to our model, I just say that there are many biological mechanisms people reported so far that are key player to this kind of mechanism, neuromodulator, feedback from the motor area, thoracocortical input, all of them are important, and they are key players. But here, I would like to study the problem for a different perspective from a more system level modeling. So our perspective is that the brain is embodied in the environment. The brain is interacting with the body and the environment, and the active behavior during the active sensing, they form a closed loop in a sense that the brain sends a motor command inference and that changes moves the body, changes the environment, and the change in the environment give a consequential change in the sensory input, which in turn changes the brain dynamics. So it constitutes closed loop feedback during active sensing, and it has been known, and those basically the sensory feedback signal is represented in the thalamus and the cortex. So we hypothesize that the closed loop sensory feedback mediated by the body and the environment plays a role in this kind of brain state transition, brain dynamics change. And how so? I will tell how so in a very simple model. It's kind of embarrassingly simple, but we say negative sensory feedback reduces neural gain, and this can explain experimental observations. So we model brain activity. B stands for the brain, and here's the brain activity, something like EEG activity. And this is a conceptual model, but it's basically a simple Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. The activity is driven by noise and just decays. So in the background, it's simply fluctuating, nothing special, and when external input is applied, the brain activity respond to external input and decays back to the baseline. Nothing special, right? And this is in the open loop condition. In the closed loop condition, the brain is interacting with the environment. And here we assume that this feedback is negative. I mean, you could also think about the positive feedback, but here I consider negative feedback. If there is a negative feedback from the environment, the background fluctuation is suppressed, something like a thermostat. Whenever the brain activity is high, the brain receives small input from the world and vice versa. So that suppresses background fluctuation as well as the response to external stimulus. Now, external stimulus is applied, but that's basically canceled by the negative feedback loop. So this already explains two things. It can suppress the coherent neural fluctuation in the background, and the response to passive whisker stimulation could be reduced because of this mechanism.
So you're saying that this results about the reduced fluctuation is because of the feedback?
Yeah, that's...
But I thought they really cut the feedback, and they found that this is... At least they cut the sensory feedback from the whisker.
Yeah, yeah. So that's an important point. They cut the sensory nerve, and they observed still brain dynamics changes. So we asked the data from Peterson's lab, and basically found that yes, it changes, but it involves extra delay, significant delay if you cut the sensory input. So the mechanism, I mean, there are redundant pathways probably to change neurodynamics, but we argue here that for quick change, you still need sensory feedback.
I'm just curious. I mean, this is basically negative feedback a la Black from 1928. I mean, that negative closed-loop gain will always have lower noise and open-loop gain, more bandwidth and lower noise.
Yeah, so that's nothing special. Yeah, but I would like to put together two experimental observations, and I later, if I have time, I would like to talk about Mija's data, zebrafish data. Okay, so that's the closed loop. And what about the difference between passive whisker diffraction and active touch? Here, we just assume if this feedback is transiently cut during the touch event, then you can combine low background fluctuation with a vigorous response to touch. The question is whether the feedback can be transiently cut during touch. So I would like to investigate this with a little bit more realistic model. It's still simple, but realistic model. So we composed a cortical circuit composed of excitatory neurons, inhibitory neurons. Basically, you can understand everything in terms of linear dynamics. But these are excitatory neurons and the inhibitory neurons recurrently interacting. And we put the adaptation current so that if no input comes in, neurons go up and down in one health cycle. So that produces low frequency fluctuations. And this is the open loop condition. In the closed loop condition, we manually turn on central pattern generator. And basically, this introduces sensory feedback via the whisker. This is a vibrissa, and I only model one whisker. And we assume that this feedback from the whisker is a negative sensory feedback. That's an important one. We model the whisker as two sticks with a hinge, where the torsion spring is controlling the angle of the whisker. So basic intuition, before that, and the cortical neurons receive two kinds of input from the whisker. One, subcortical or cortical. Yeah, that is in. Yes, so this is an aggregate of everything. So, that's very important. Here, this label might be confusing, but this neuron pool is, in a sense, the composite of thalamus and the cortex and motor neurons. It's a brain. Let's start from this simple model and see how far we can go. So we model two kinds of input. One is the input pulse when whisker hits a wall, and the other is a sort of encoding the whisker angle, reafferent input. It's encoding the whisker angle. So two kinds of input is injected to this cortex. The whisker is sinusoidally driven by a central pattern generator, but there is additional modulation by cortical excitatory neurons.
Is that critical to the model, that green arrow?
It's important that it composes a closed loop feedback. Well, so as I said, this is kind of the chunk of the brain model. So I don't have a detailed separation of sensory area and the motor area.
No, forget about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the point is, if you can cut that green arrow,
yeah,
that would be a critical test of feedback.
That's right. Exactly. That's a critical experiment.
Cool.
Yeah, that's very important. That's very important. So. The question is why the feedback can be transiently cut during the active touch. So in this model, basically when the whisker hits a wall, and if
the feedback here, you mean what should be cut during the catch? Which arrow?
So here, excitatory neurons, it doesn't depend on the detail, but here, when excitatory neurons fire, the whisker moves forward.
Yes.
And the sensory input from the whisker is higher when the whisker is backward. So what?
This red arrow, you want to cut it during the touch.
Right. So during the touch, if the whisker is rigid, the angle doesn't move despite the cortical input. Therefore, the feedback is suppressed. That's why feedback is cut in this model. Yeah, David is much more expert on that. Okay, so let's just move ahead. We again assume that this feedback is negative and basically simulate this model. We can simulate what is the neural activity when the animal. This is rate model, but it doesn't matter. As long as a linear.
Because we can talk about fast event, like touch, rate model is not successful. If you talk about slow missing activity, it's great. Okay, and it goes back to, let's say, old shaky and big data.
No, no, no. I mean, this is like. You can think about inhomogeneous Poisson process. With a time-changing input. Okay, so we can simulate in the quiet condition, open loop condition, whisking condition, the active touch condition, and you can see that the fluctuation is bigger here, fluctuation is smaller here. We can quantify this thing in a similar way to experiments. This is a power spectrum of the membrane potential of neurons and a correlation between nearby neurons. And again, you can see that the coherent neural fluctuation is suppressed in this model during the closed loop whisking behavior relative to the open loop quiet condition. And interestingly, the active touch condition is somewhere in the middle. This is because in this model, active touch period is half closed loop, half open loop. Therefore, it's in the middle of the open and the closed loop condition.
Why is it half open, half closed?
Because when the whisker is touching an object, it's open loop because the feedback is cut.
For the rest of the time, it's,
for the rest of the time, it's closed loop. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so it has an interesting suggestion for the sensory processing. Here we plot the sensory discriminability in terms of signal-to-noise ratio. We characterize signal-to-noise ratio. The signal is the response to input pulse, and the noise is the background fluctuation level. And we simulate membrane potential dynamics in three conditions and plotted this signal-to-noise ratio. What we can find is that the signal-to-noise ratio in the open-loop condition is this amount. It's basically a combination of big background fluctuation, noisy fluctuation, and the big response. And that gives the ratio here. In the closed-loop condition, the background fluctuation is small, suppressed by negative feedback, and the response to pulse is also suppressed. And that gives the signal-to-noise ratio here. And during the simulated touch condition, closed-loop feedback is transiently cut during the touch. And depending on the whisker stiffness, you can amplify the signal-to-noise ratio. For a wide range of stiffness, you can amplify the sensory discriminability.
Excuse me. You said during the closed-loop condition, the
In the closed loop condition, yes.
Compared
to this cyan line?
Right. So but that's a very long time scale, no? What's the time scale of the background feedback?
Oh, this is slow one. What we characterize is like a 1 hertz frequency, 1 to 5 hertz.
Until you know, what is the time scale of the feedback circuit?
Feedback of the time scale is reasonably fast. I think like the order of 100 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds.
Maybe it's fast or slow.
But the fluctuation is slow. It's 1 hertz or 5 hertz.
I was trying to get the time scale right, that's all.
Yeah, so it cannot.
You're still getting 10 hertz fluctuations if you go forward again.
Right.
Can you go to the next slide? Yeah, so I'm still seeing the 10 hertz, 100 millisecond fluctuations are still present.
Uh-huh.
Or is getting lost this fluctuation of the time scale of like 300 hertz.
So there is a whisking time scale of the 10 hertz on top of it, produced by CPG.
Can you repeat what the stiffness parameter enters in
the model? Oh, the stiffness is that how much the whisker bends when it hits the wall. If it's very soft, it doesn't cut the feedback because the angle can still move. But if it's very stiff, it hits and it doesn't move anymore during the hit. So that cuts the feedback. Okay, so that's the whisker model. We could explain the two experimental observations. And I just want to quickly say how to experimentally test this kind of idea. And you can actually compare this closed loop condition versus replay condition. Like the replay condition Misha tried with the zebrafish model. Basically, you can record the sensory input during the closed loop and play back and see what the response is. In a dynamical systems, it's clear that the brain responds differently in the closed loop condition versus replay condition because the internal noise seed is different in this versus this. So this is a cleaner control case. And basically, I don't have much time, but we wanted to see with Misha's zebrafish experiment, how neural fluctuation is different in the closed loop conditions versus replay condition, and is it related to the feedback from the environment? Basically, that's what we wanted to do. So if we look at the data of Misha, I mean, it's very heterogeneous. Some neurons are more fluctuating or less fluctuating during the closed loop condition. But our hypothesis is that is accounted for by the environmental feedback. So we fit how strong is the environmental feedback from the replay data. In the replay condition, the visual stimulus activated GCAMP. GCAMP produced the motor behavior. Just looking at this replay condition, we fit the filter. How much the visual stimulus activates the brain, neural dynamics, and how much the GCAMP activate the motor behavior. So with this, we fitted the filters, quantifying how strong is the environmental feedback. And based on this feedback strength, we predicted how much the fluctuation should be suppressed in the closed loop condition relative to the open loop condition. You know, if the interaction is negative, we would expect stabilization. Otherwise, we would expect increase. So this is the predicted fluctuation, closed loop divided by leap rate versus actually experimentally observed fluctuations. And they are correlated. So this is predicted by the filter, environmental filter. This is actually experimentally observed. they have a reasonable correlation. And we were particularly interested in this part of the cells here. They have strong negative feedback, and they are stabilized during the closed loop behavior. And we looked at where they are located. They are located in the cerebellum and perhaps in the inferior olive, consistent with the observation that they are involved in optomotor behaviors. So with that, we could account for the mice experiments and the fish data. We want to say we're just not the brain. Modeling environment is very important to understand brain dynamics. Thank you. Yeah, I want to say that Chris Buckley did a wonderful job, and I would like to thank Misha and Carl Peterson for the data.
But it doesn't work. Something to be, there is a switch or something.
Somebody can help, experimentalists.
What happened?
I don't know, I put in HDMI.
HDMI,
I don't have VGA.
Here we go.
Ah.
What did you do?
The presence of experiment.
You just came.
Okay, so. Thank you very much for inviting me. I would like to present you this work that I've been doing with Jonathan Lemmerstein and Simon Rumpel for quite some time now. And I hope to... It's okay? Like this? Like this?
Okay.
And so, I will try. And yes, I wanted to discuss these points here in the title, so synaptic volatility and inhibitory plasticity, that are to some extent experimental observation, and I would like to discuss how this relates to kind of the standard theory that we have, which is this synaptic trace theory of memory, where the basic idea is that information is stored for a long time into synaptic modifications, okay? And I will try to argue, try to elicit discussions about if these data are fully consistent with the theory, at least in one, let's say, naive interpretation. This is the outline, so I will start by just showing you these results about synaptic dynamics in vivo. It comes from spine imaging. And then, as I said, I will discuss some of the implication of these dynamics for learning and memory storage, and if I have time, I will suggest some directions. Okay, I guess you are all familiar with this, so spines are basically anatomical structures that you can find on the dendrites, and typically excitatory synapse ends on spines. And so if you see a spine, essentially there is very, very high probability that there will be an excitatory synapse on it. And more interesting, or importantly to some extent, is that basically the volume of the spines correlates with the synaptic efficacy. Here you have some example of these measure spine volume versus several measures of synaptic efficacy. So essentially, in first approximation, you can say that the spine volume is a very good proxy of the synaptic efficacies. And now what's interesting is that you can kind of chronically image the spine, so you can follow these synaptic dynamics in vivo. As we were discussing yesterday with Nicolas and Robert, most of the data about synaptic plasticity or synaptic dynamics come from in vitro preparations, and to some extent it's not clear how much they are relevant to in vivo dynamics. So this is a way to look at these dynamics in kind of physiological condition. And this is, I think, is one of the first experiments where they looked at correlation between synaptic dynamics and learning. Okay, so this is basic prediction of the theory, is that if the animal learns something, then you should see change in the connectivity. And this is, in fact, what they observe. So there is a task. I will not go into the details. So you have some learning curve, so you can see the behavior changes. And now you can basically look at spines on the dendrites and across days or weeks, and you can look at modifications. Okay, and in fact, when they did this, essentially you can see that in the case of successful training, there was in fact a significant change in these dynamics. In this specific case, it was an increase in the rate of spine formation. Okay, it correlates with learning. So this is okay. I mean, it's completely consistent with the theory. What is a little bit less is that, in fact, also in the control condition, you have significant dynamics by these measures. So you have rate of formation and elimination of these spines, which is comparable with the rate that you observe during learning. Okay. So this is a little bit less consistent. And basically, Jonathan and Simon looked in quite some detail at this ongoing dynamics. So these are control animals, so they're not doing anything. They just take a picture. Here is the data set. You have six time points over 4 days interval. This is kind of the data that you get. This is the raw data, so this would be the same part of dendrite across two different sessions, and you see that there are something that stays the same. This would be the blue arrow. 4 days. Huh? 4 days.
So is it always that it looks like the dendrite shape is exactly the same? So there was no movement at all. Is it always like that?
They are, I think they are extremely stable, and then there is some kind of Z projection that you do. I don't know the details, but you project this in a specific direction, so probably this contributes to this. But anyway, the measure, they are relatively stable. Yeah.
At this level, everything is rock solid.
Well, the people have reported no change in dendritic length, for instance.
Okay.
Relatively stable. Yeah, I will discuss part of this. In any case, these are excitatory synapses on excitatory neurons. And okay, you can see that there is something is the same, something is changed. And so you can do some statistics with this. And this is reported here. So you see that, so basically a black line means that there was a spine in a specific session. And then if it becomes white, means that the spine disappeared. And if something white becomes black, something appeared. And you can see that basically at every session you have a fraction of spines that have disappeared and a fraction of spines that have appeared, and this goes on all the time. What's interesting is that now if you count the number of spines for a given neuron, well, this number is reasonably constant, or it's essentially constant. So you have a creation, formation, but on average there is no change in the net number.
So the bottom are the stable.
Yeah, this one are the stable spine that I'm discussing in the next slide. So the next, about the stable spine, you can ask if there is there was any other change. And in fact, what happens is that you have quite large fluctuations in the spine volume that, as I said at the beginning, is a proxy for synaptic efficacies. Also, here there is something which is interesting, is that these dynamics are steady in the sense that the distribution of spine volume doesn't change even if you have fluctuation, positive and negative fluctuation, okay? So, well, conclusion that you can draw from these observation, these studies, that in a sense ongoing spine dynamics preserve the statistical features of the connectivity, okay? But in a sense, if you think of these as a let's say a fine wiring of the circuit, which is actually where the memories are supposed to be, this looks like big changes, at least let's say first glance. And so, well, it's summarized here. You can see basically probability of survival as a function of time, and you can see that.
So this is in one particular area.
This is auditory cortex. Layer 2, 3. This has been replicated in several preparations, cortical and hippocampal. Numbers differ, and the interpretation of the numbers differ. But basically, everybody has reported this ongoing volatility. So, for instance, in the hippocampus, it's been estimated that within 2 weeks, all the connections are new connections. Okay, so one question, if now you think in terms of this synaptic trace theory of memory, so the question is how you basically keep memories if there is this large dynamics going on. This is in a situation where the animal is not learning anything new and lives in a very impoverished environment. But so obviously we are not the first one to notice this, so there's been several proposals as possible solutions to this problem. And they essentially boils down in three, I would say, families of solutions. So the idea is that, you know, if you store memories in the synaptic structure, then some feature of the synaptic structure has to be stable. Okay, now you can decide what's the feature that you want to be stable. And essentially you have three options. One option is that, well, the site of storage is a spine. Okay, so there would be some spine that are very stable, and that's where the memory is. And in fact, is, as we were discussing with Stefano, a fraction of the spine, about 30%, seems to be more stable than the other one. Okay.
There are fluctuations
in the size. So the question is, kind of, what's the analogical depth of your coding? That's also a problem. Another solution is that, in fact, the spine doesn't correspond to a functional connection, because connection is made of multiple spines. So in fact, this noise that you see is not really there. So the spine fluctuates, but on average, you have the same number of spines on the same neuron, so the connection is stable. So actually, there is no noise. And the third possibility is that, in fact, yeah, the network will change synaptic configuration, but this synaptic configuration will produce the same dynamics and then the same computation. So in this sense, would retrieve the same memories, okay? So we did something else, and we started by taking seriously this change. And so we asked what's going to happen in a network if you simulate this change in a network. So what we did, we built a kind of standard spiking network. So you have excitatory inhibitory neurons. They are randomly connected. And the only difference is that we basically try to put in this, yes?
Can I ask a question about the previous slide?
Sure.
How much is known about whether spines can communicate if one spine disappears? Could there be something triggered in other spines to appear or abstract?
There are a lot of studies that say that this will happen in clustering, or other studies that say, so apparently there is some correlation in, you know, where you are located compared to other spine. So
in a way that could contribute to stabilization?
Sure, but this would be this one of these possibilities, that apart from the mechanism, right? You have some kind of something that looks fluctuation, but that the relevant statistics is preserved. That's what you're saying, basically. I have no idea.
I mean, there is some evidence that there is, if you induce synaptic plasticity on one spine, then the neighboring spines within about 50 micrometers will have a greater chance of changing strength in the next 11 minutes or so. So there is something like that. I don't know what it could be, but it could be there.
There are studies that show this. Okay, so
your solution number one and two, their goal would be that the firing rate of the neuron will not change.
Well, the
solution number three, you have an example firing rate.
Right, I will discuss. Right, I will discuss some of these at the end. The problem is that in this kind of preparation, you cannot record the activity and the synaptic dynamics at the same time. They tell me that it's extremely complicated to do experimentally.
I don't want to take thunder away from your prediction, but at least in hippocampus, it is known that the rat simply walks back and forth on the same track day after day. In a matter of 1 week, the entire ensemble comes over at the level of somatic spiking.
Yeah.
So there is some seeming instability, even at the level of spiking afterwards, which could either be caused by this or it
This we can discuss. It's complicated because most of this change you see also in absence of spiking activity. So part of this dynamics is activity independent.
But unresolved, I mean, the fields that are there, when they are present, they are in the same spot. So yes, yeah. The cell may be dropping down a bit, but there is a map stability, representational stability, although.
Still have the same map, just that you will sample yourself. But there is clearly something remains. It's not just completely shuffling.
Yeah, but I think it is slowly degrading. The overlap will be degrading.
My paper today was that there is a very stable map, and you just get a different base, different cells.
Yeah.
Active or not active, but clearly things are.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it doesn't totally.
So there should be some trace.
Yeah, but if there's substantial change.
That's a debate, in fact. Okay, so I was saying we just try to simulate this in a model network just to see what happens. And well, we use a pretty standard model network, and the only difference, I mean, we try to pay attention to actual numbers. So we used estimation of the different parameters that enters into the theory, estimation from the experiments. So eventually, in this model, there are only two free parameters that are the external inputs to excitatory and inhibitory population that we set by asking that the average firing rate in the population would be comparable, consistent with what people report in the cortex in vivo. And this would be something around about 1 hertz for excitation and about 5-10 hertz for inhibition. Okay. And just to show you how the activity in the network looks like. So activity in the spiking is irregular. This is driven by fluctuations. And because the network is randomly connected, there will be heterogeneity in the firing rate. And also this heterogeneity in the firing rates is consistent with what is observed in the court. So this will be kind of log normal distribution with a pretty long tail. Okay, this is just to show that kind of the activity regime of the network is not completely crazy and reproduce basic features of the activity in the cortex, okay? And then, this one? This is the excitatory population and this is the inhibitory population.
Oh, okay.
Okay, they have the same shape, but firing rates are different, so the distributions are different.
The effect was when we showed those who fire, but what is the percentage of the neurons that are almost completely silent?
In this network, there are no neurons completely silent. Everything. Okay. No, no, but
the minus 2 is the minimum.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. Okay, and then we simulated these dynamics that we observed, and the way we did is probably the simplest way you can do. So to each synapse in the model, you attach a spine, and then you change the synapse the same way the spine changes. Okay, so if the spine doubles the volume, we double the synaptic efficacy. If the spine disappears, we remove the synapse. If the spine appears, we put the synapse. Okay, so this way you generate essentially 6 networks, and the E2E connectivity is is generated in this way. So you can see that just by eye, this is 10 by 10 connectivity. Most of it is blue because the network is sparsely connected, but just by eye, you can see that there is difference in consistent with the data that I just shown. Okay, so there are modification in this connectivity. But if you look at the activity, so you see the distribution, excitation, inhibition, and this is just a random sample of 20 neurons. So this would be a vector of firing rates. And you see, well, that the average distribution doesn't change. This you would expect because statistics of the connectivity is the same. But you would have expected that the specific pattern of activity would be changing as a result of this modification, because the specific firing rates of the neuron depends on the fine structure of the connectivity. This, in fact, doesn't happen, and here you can see a quantification of this. So this is the autoparallelogram of the synaptic matrix that goes down, consistent with the experimental data, but inhibition and excitation, this is the autoparallelogram of the vector of firing rates, these hardly changes, okay? And This is the synaptic matrix. So you take the synaptic, and this is the activity. So essentially, this tells you that you have a significant change in the connectivity,
yeah,
in the excitatory part of the matrix, but no, hardly any change in the.
Do you make anything of two vectors?
Yeah.
Now that no correlation you see in the connectivity of inhibition, synaptic inhibition.
Yeah.
Essentially, what I'm saying is that the rate at which your correlations are decaying, it seems to be proportional to the firing rates of that process.
No.
Now, what is your rate of inhibition? Each spine's activation.
No, well, inhibition doesn't change. This is only. So maybe I didn't understand you.
The firing rate of any process is high, such as inhibition. It remains correlated.
Well, it's partly this is the explanation eventually.
That's
a part that's related to the firing rates.
Right.
Yeah.
But can you just explain what it is? You simulated it for some time.
You take
the average firing rates of
the right. You take these 6 networks. You simulate these 6 networks for 3 minutes.
Then you auto-correlated the average.
Right, and you get a vector of firing grades, and now, right, and now you do the second, and you say how similar they are. You just compute the correlation coefficient, and this is what is plotted here. And you can do the same with the synaptic matrix, and this is what is plotted here.
There's one small methodological point that when you're computing correlation between processes, as the size of the entries gets larger, then the noise would start dominating. So that what I mean is that the number of synapses are probably much more than the number of cells.
Oh, yeah,
and
sure.
The number of cells are more than the number of ABC cells. So if you were to subsample the population, so if you have the same number of arbitrarily selected inhibition neurons, excitatory neurons, and spines, I wonder if the correlations will be in the same time.
I don't know. Luckily, we have all the neurons and all the synapses in this network. So
you have the data. From your data, you just subsample.
Looks identical, so actually it's almost perfect correlation. So no matter how you subsample, you will get one.
In this case, they are very similar. So Anyway.
Last question on that. So how are you simulating the waves through that network? You're driving it with...
This is a spiking network. Now it's just, you know, it's just tonically active, some kind of spontaneous activity state. We run simulation for some time, and we just count the number of spikes of each neuron and divide by time interval.
So, I mean, so the input in the network is some static thing.
Right, exactly. 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 The only heterogeneity in the neurons is the connection they receive. Otherwise, they are identical. And then we did, well, we were a little bit surprised by this result, so we did something a little bit more aggressive, which we called rewiring. And essentially what you do, you take two networks. They are identical apart from one synaptic population, for instance, excitation, that are two independent realization of the same process. Okay, so the connectivity is the same, but they are completely uncorrelated. Okay, so this would correspond to zero on the black curve here. And if you do this, basically you will see that this, you have to, the black dots are the results of the simulation. And even if you rewire all the excited to excited connectivity, which is 50% of the synapses in this network, essentially, there is no effect on the pattern of activity of the excitation. If you do excitation inhibition, it's about 20%. Well, you have a larger effect, but nothing really dramatic. But now, if you rewire inhibition onto excitation, you have a very dramatic effect. So the pattern of activity in the excited network is completely changed. And even more interesting to some, in some sense, is that if you rewire inhibition onto inhibition, so you're not changing anything going synaptic, going to the excited population, you have a change in the pattern of activity which is larger than if you were to rewire all the excited connections. Okay?
What is 50%?
Here is the number of synapses. So 50% of the synapses in this model network are excited to excited synapses. I generate two E2E connectivities that are statistically equivalent. Yeah, it's random permutation. Yeah.
So the synaptic changes in your case, they're not driven by the activity. The network is not learning anything.
It's not doing anything. It's just
spontaneous.
How is that possible?
Yeah, but it's not even affected by the spontaneous
activity. No, it's just the network is fixed connections, but
the network doesn't
change connections.
The synaptic changes do not depend on the.
No.
There are no synaptic change per se. You have just six networks. In this case, you have two networks. They are all this.
Okay, it's like a situation in which you change randomly the wire.
Exactly. It's exactly what I do.
It does not depend on the activity.
Yeah. Not at all. Yeah.
In the worst case, because you completely.
Well, you might have a much bigger change if the
communication
depends on the activity.
Sure. Yeah. I'm assuming that there is no correlation between activity and okay.
Is that, do you have an intuition why? I mean, there are fewer individual neurons and intuition in viewers is very important. Is that why you're seeing this pattern or there's something?
I'm explaining. It's a very simple explanation. So you just consider one neuron in this network and imagine that you were to just swap two synapses, right? This one with this one. Then clearly, if the product of these two terms is the same, well, there will be no change, right? If I switch two synapses, they have the same efficacy, well, you will make no change. If I switch, if the synapses are different, but the activity of the neurons is the same, well, there will be no difference again, okay? And in a large network, basically this rewiring that we did is equivalent to just make, as Misha was saying, just make a random permutation. Okay, so just this argument just suggests that the larger is the variance of this term, the larger will be the effect on network activity. Just because you have a larger, you can make larger changes by doing these operations. And in fact, if you now take the numbers and compute, let's say, the typical change that you can make by rewiring excitation and the typical change that you can make by rewiring inhibition, well, you discover that essentially the typical change that you can make by rewiring inhibition is 20 times larger than the typical change.
You only change the weights,
no.
But you didn't do any structural change, so you did both.
No, I just, you randomly regenerate, so this would be like permuting these weights.
So you have also all weights, or?
No, they're random.
So here there are no zero, you're only looking at the weights. Here it looks like you only change the weights.
Yeah, here I did. No, in reality I have also remove and put synonym, so it's yeah.
And this argument would still hold.
Yeah. So just now you'll have additional source of variance that is if you connected the node.
Does this include the fact that the EI or
IA
are stronger using higher weight
value? Right, so that's the question. So now this could depend on different things. But again, if you look at the numbers, these essentially, all the other things are comparable. So average synaptic efficacy, width of distribution, they are comparable. The very large difference is in the firing rates. And that's essentially why this.
This is the spontaneous firing rate.
This is the spontaneous firing rate.
The interesting situation would be the one under stimulation, where the firing rate would be.
No, where under stimulation would be exactly the same, even less.
Under stimulation, the excitatory neurons can fire at 100 Hz in monkeys.
Ah, you say just.
But that's the interesting situation. It's when
there are several interesting situations. So we can discuss this.
Well, I think that's surprising.
I think that we can discuss also the 200.
It's irrelevant.
No. It's not true. This gives you a bound, okay? This tells you if you have a net that is not doing anything and you just randomly rewire, nothing will happen. So, yeah, I want to reply to this. And
if
so,
there are no, you would certainly have correlations between the neural activity and the synapses, because the synapses, if they do some computation, they will not be just completely random.
But about the 200 Hz, so certainly you can find cells that fire 200 Hz. But if you look at the distribution of the activity, in, let's say baseline versus stimulation change, they are not huge change. At the population level, there will be no huge change.
There's a small fraction of cells that will be activated. But if those are correlated with the synapses that count, then the statistics is very different in your mean field of patients.
That's the problem, probably part of what you're saying I can address, actually we address, this is not doing anything. So now you can ask, okay, what if the network is doing something a little bit more sophisticated, just having spontaneous activity? So one thing that you can do is, given that we started doing memory, you can put memory in this network, okay? And we did this in the standard way. I don't think I have to elaborate too much on this. So you just randomly generate a subset of neurons and you assign them to be memory number mu. You will say that memory is correctly stored if you have a state of activity in this network so that the activity of this subset of neurons is higher than average firing rate. And the storage is pretty standard up to some point, so this is a standard covariance rule. This is basically the Smithian model. And this is just a normalization that gives you, in the limit of a very large number of patterns, this would be Gaussian with zero mean variance one. And this term here we used to control the level of symmetry, because this is a completely symmetric rule. And specifically, to be consistent with the random network that we have, we choose this to be anti-correlated, okay? So these zeta variables will be completely uncorrelated. So if you encode in ij, you will not encode in ji. And using this term, then we go through a non-linear transformation that generates the actual weights.
So in context, we know that there are correlations.
Yeah. In principle, you could put the right amount of correlations and see what happens. We didn't do this because we wanted to be consistent with the random method that we have used. And if you put the correlation, the theory complicates a lot. But sure, by numerical simulation, you could look at it. And for what I'm showing, I don't think this will make a large effect, provided that when you rewire with the same amount of symmetry. And we just use Hebbian learning rule for excitatory synapses and anti-Hebbian for inhibitory synapses. Okay, this just means that the larger this term, the larger will be the W, and the larger this term, the smaller will be the W. Okay. And the way we choose this F function is just to reproduce the same marginal statistics in the random network. This is something that looks like this. And you just project this, and you will get the marginal distribution that you want. So this is, apart from the coding level, this is a parameter-free learning rule. We just reproduce the same statistics. And now you can embed memories, and you can ask what's going on if you... So this is what we did. This is just random network, structured network. Everything is the same as before, apart the fact that now there are memories. In this case, we stored 2,000 memories, and in fact, you can see that the network can retrieve these memories. So this is stimulation. You activate this subset. Then the simulation is gone, and you see that this activity persists. This is the overlap, basically the correlation between this binary vector and the vector of firing rates. And you can see that the others are around zero, and you have this switch. OK, now we can play the same game as before. And for instance, we rewire the E2E connectivity. OK, so now the marginal will be the same, but actually there is no correlation between the memory and the synaptic efficacies. And again, you can see that nothing dramatic happens. The memory is still there.
So this is just because you get the negative connection.
All the rest is structured. Yeah, so this means not...
You only rewire between.
Only rewire between.
So the others are enough.
Yeah, that's why you have still memory. And if you do the same with I to I, well, the memory disappears. Okay, so also in this case, you have this observation that, you know, changing excitatory connection has not too much effect on, in this case, in the function, so memory function in the network, but if you touch inhibition, you have very strong effect. And in fact, you can, for this model, you can do a kind of mean field analysis, and you can, in fact, estimate the storage capacity. It's defined here. And these are the different kind of synaptic configurations. So you have, let's say, the standard model where all information is in the E2E connections. And in this specific case, you would get about 250 patterns. But if you do the same in the I to I connection, you will get 1,000 patterns. And if you structure all the connections, you will get almost 2,700 patterns. And so the two simulations that I showed correspond to this case and this case. Okay? And you can see that in this case, your storage capacity is larger than 2,000. Okay, this is 40,000 neurons network. Okay, so this is above 2,000, this is below 2,000. And that's the reason, 40,000. That's the reason why in one case. Ah, sorry, okay, that's what, okay, so this I will skip, and that's just my conclusion. I've written there, we can discuss after. No, well, that's basically the conclusion, so that if you consider a change that I didn't show part of it, so it's not exactly clear, but if you consider change that preserve these statistics of the connection, well, then if you want to make large changes, you have to change the inhibition. The inhibition is necessary and sufficient to induce this change. And well, I cannot talk about this because I didn't show.
So you are thinking that inhibitory connections are more stable.
No, that would be one prediction. No, that's so. The idea is that
that's your solution that you propose.
Exactly. So the inhibitory network controls the information that you store and you keep. There are there are different kind of evidence. So there is some evidence that shows that, in fact, well, when you learn, you have also change in the inhibitory connectivity. There is some evidence that change, if you prevent change in inhibitory connectivity, in fact, you will specifically affect long-term storage rather than the immediate performance. And there are some lines of evidence that, let's say, this volatility would be slower for inhibitory synapses. But
so there is some
yeah, there are a series of. Yeah, so this I didn't discuss. So actually, in our theoretical framework, there is no role for inhibition in memory storage, right? And so at some point people discovered, perhaps not surprisingly, also inhibitory synapse change. So the question is why they change. And one theory has been proposed, so Maoz is one of the proponents of this theory, is that in fact you need inhibitory plasticity in order to preserve the balance. So you would have if you change excitation, then you have to adjust inhibition, otherwise you would go. And so this is kind of homeostatic hypothesis. This predicts that essentially the inhibitory plasticity should mirror the excitatory plasticity. Because if the excitation goes up, so that means if excitatory plasticity is Hebbian, well, inhibitory plasticity should be Hebbian too. And in this specific case, there is that if you want to use inhibition to store memories, well, the plasticity has to be anti-Hebbian. So prediction of this theory is that physiological condition, inhibitory plasticity should be anti-Hebbian rather than Hebbian. Well, this from the experiment, for instance, is not fully consistent with the homeostatic. I would not say it's consistent with this, but yeah.
Okay.
That's it. Thank you.
We have two more.